Back together, you and I, on a Tuesday, December 7th, 2021, right here on Connecticut Today. We had a return visit from columnist and NYU politics professor Lawrence Mead on whether or not our border policies are slowly fracturing the U.S. Yankee Institute policy analyst Ken Girardin detailed a brand new report regarding the fiscal health of Connecticut's cities and towns. And I also had some remarks during the show wondering why the country has a continued inability to properly police the southern U.S. border with Mexico. And we thank Professor Lawrence Mead, NYU, once again one of our go-to guys on the border, talking about border issues and all that. New numbers out from the federal government, or at least somebody is making this, making these numbers top shelf here. Interesting feature here from the Washington Free Beacon. It's an online publication that does lean very conservative. I get that. I understand that. But they've cited documents and numbers that they've gotten here through freedom of information here from the federal government. Deportations of illegal immigrants, including those convicted of serious crimes like burglary and homicide, dropped to the lowest levels in decades during the first 6 months of President Joe Biden's term. That's according to numbers from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I'll read that again if you need it read any slower. Deportations of illegal immigrants, including those convicted of serious crimes like burglary and homicide. Homicide means you've killed someone, if you don't like big words. Dropped to their lowest levels in decades during the first 6 months of the Biden White House. In total, deportations of illegals from January 21 of 2021 through this past July 9th dropped by 90% compared with the same time period during 2019, the last year before the COVID pandemic, which grounded attempted migration to nearly a halt in the U.S. Data was obtained by a Freedom of Information Act request. The curb in deportations extends to all types of illegal immigrants living in the U.S., including those with criminal convictions. Isn't that great? Deportations of illegals with convictions for crimes like aggravated assault, kidnapping, sexual assault, and homicide fell by double-digit numbers in the first 6 months of 2021 when compared with the previous 2 years. The number of illegal immigrants with serious criminal convictions deported declined by more than 50% from 2020 and 65% from 2019. Well, there it is, folks. There's certain political factions in this country, as Lawrence Mead just told us a couple of seconds ago, that it is sacramental to them. It is on level with a religious sacrament that we go easy on people on the border. So there you go. I still cannot. The more I try and figure it out. The more I think about this, the more I look at the numbers, and again, these numbers that are cited by the Washington Free Beacon and others were obtained by a Freedom of Information Act request from the Center for Immigration Studies. And the numbers are there, and the deportations are down, and you have to ask why. I don't know. Are there people in this country that would, for some reason, I don't understand what the phobia is about securing the borders? There is a cadre of people in this country who think it should be okay to violate our border. Seriously. They think it should be okay to violate the border. Well, Paul, you know, these people are coming from such horrible conditions. And how long have these horrible conditions been there? In a lot of these countries that continue to be run by corrupt governments and corrupt institutions, despite hundreds of millions and billions of dollars they get in aid. And again, what other country on the face of the earth allows this? What is it? What other country allows this to happen on a daily basis? We hear constantly from the ICE officials and the Border Patrol officials about the problems they have every day, and yet people think it's perfectly okay that you can just waltz across the border, get released in this country, and maybe show up for a hearing. How is that okay in 2021? Who actually thinks that's fine? You call me. You tell me. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Why are we so soft at the border? Why is that? Why do we just let people walk right across, or at least attempt to do that? Why do we let people purposely, with incredible purpose, just go ahead and overwhelm the system, which is what their goal is? The goal is to overwhelm the system. Do we think that little of ourselves now as a country, where we just sit here and say, oh yeah, come on, whatever, because it's not right. It's not. We need to grow a set again when it comes to the border. Oh, people want to come to our country. Well, there's a way to do that. There's a way to do that. It's called legal immigration, like the guy down the street from me did from my condo, and he's owned his fourth convenience store already. So there is ways you can do it. But we take a few minutes out now to talk about, again, one of those third rail topics in politics you can't touch, because if you have a notion to actually fix it, or point out how ludicrous the current policies are, you're immediately branded a racist, a xenophobe, whatever. We welcome back to the program. We've had this gentleman on a couple of times before. He's a professor of politics at NYU in the city, author of Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference, and The American Power. He hosts the Poverty and Culture podcast, and his latest piece you can read at townhall.com. The Border Crisis and American Culture. Professor Lawrence Mead is back with us. Professor, hi, it's Paul here again at WICC. Good to have you back. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
And we seem, Professor, to have this problem that goes on and on and on. It's worse now maybe than it's ever been, but our inexplicable, or maybe it is explainable, I don't know, but our inexplicable lack of guts to do what a lot of people think is right at the border, Professor. It's mind-boggling to me. It really is.
Yes, it is. I think it's a very strange situation. Americans are opposed to an open border, but they somehow don't have any influence over the situation. This reflects in part what Biden said he would do when he was running for president. He said he would have a more humane policy towards immigrants than the Trump administration. So that encouraged more people to come forward to the border, whether or not they were legal. And then two other factors, the legal structure surrounding immigration is completely broken down. It's now possible for virtually anybody to cross the border and claim asylum and thereby stay in America. So it isn't at all what we think we should be doing. But we can't stop it because the administration's policies and preferences really don't allow that.
And you point out here, Professor, in part of your piece here, your latest piece, that the system is overwhelmed. And I have said numerous times, maybe this is what the intention is, overwhelm the system until they throw their hands up in the air.
Well, I don't think it's deliberate. I think it's rather that to close the border would involve serious political costs for this administration and its supporters. And they're prepared to tolerate that rather than go back to anything like the policies we had under Trump. Trump, whatever you say, was doing what the public wanted. He definitely wanted to close the border and control it and have immigration be legalized. That wasn't really possible because some of the things Trump did could be challenged in court. They were counter to previous regulations. So what Trump did was wise in the short term, but in the end, we have to change the rules so that we can really get control. And we're a long ways away from that now.
NYU Professor Lawrence Mead is the guest. Professor, hang on with you. We'll be right back. More with Professor Lawrence Mead. First, though, traffic and weather together right here, 336 on WICC. And we continue with Professor Lawrence Mead. We've had him on the show before. Professor Mead, a professor of politics at NYU, columnist too, podcast host as well. Check out his latest on townhall.com, the border crisis and American culture. And, you know, Professor Mead, you make an interesting point in this piece. The minute that a lot of people bring up, hey, this is uncontrollable, this is unsustainable, we have to tune up here, tighten up, refine the system here, you collectively, as people who argue this, you or we get the morals argument thrown back in our face. Talk a little about that.
One of the features of the immigration debate is that the political discussion is almost completely one-sided. The advocates for more immigration really dominate discussion inside the Beltway, and there isn't any serious advocacy for people outside who advocate stronger limits. That is because the debate is dominated by the idea that we owe something to people who are miserable overseas. And indeed, they are miserable. And indeed, we should do something. But what we can't do is simply have the border be open, because then we really threaten the nature of American society. That is not something that most Americans want. They want to do something, but they don't want to have the country taken over by people from foreign countries. And that is the way it's going now. So we really have to set some limits. And for that, we have to be able to reconsider the morals involved. We can't have a simply one-sided debate where people who are in need, and they're certainly in need, have a complete dominance of the question. We really do have to set some limits, and we have to have a way to understand that that allows us not to have our lives completely dominated by people coming from poor countries. The way it's going now, it's going to become more and more of a burden. Mm. Again, I'm not saying we should avoid all immigration. That's too strong. But it should be controlled, it should be legal, and it should reflect public preferences.
And, you know, Professor Mead, oftentimes, particularly people on the left will say, well, you know, these countries are so, we have to let more people in and look at the terror these countries are going through. And I always laugh and think, well, you know what, some of our allies, some of America's biggest allies, Professor Mead, have immigration policies far stricter than ours. I mean, look at the countries that have, for example, we have a family-based system. Look at our allies, Professor, who I think that's a good idea. You have a points-based system to get into the country. Yeah. So the emotional part of it, Professor, is stripped out.
Yeah. That's actually not clearly better. It's not absolutely clear what the system should be. What is clear is that we right now have excessive leniency towards family reunification as well as illegal immigration. The current rules allow people who come into the country legally to bring in most of their family as well. And that goes too far. We really have to have some limits. And right now we don't really have limits. And so, again, the advocates are in favor of continually more admissions to the country, and that's what we have to question. The most important thing, I think, is not so much to determine who gets in, but to set overall limits. I think the immigration level should be something like half what we have now. And the reason is, without that, we really can't assimilate people. They're coming from a very different world than the one that America represents, and it takes a considerable adjustment. And we have to do something to help them, and I'm all for there. But we can't do it with indefinite numbers, and that's where we are now.
Professor Lawrence Mead is the guest from NYU. Check out his latest piece in townhall.com. He also hosts a podcast as well. You know, Professor, the argument that always kills me, too, and I hear from some of my very good friends on the other side of the aisle as well, you know, if you don't have these illegals coming in to pick your lettuce and to pick your fruit, it's going to cost more. Well, okay, it costs more. And I asked them back, so we're deciding our morals as a country and security plans on the basis of what produce costs? I mean, come on, seriously.
Well, it actually, cost is not the big problem. With the produce, with the farms, farmers do need labor to come in and help harvest the crops. That's something we probably can't avoid. We have to find a way, however, to do that without having it become an open door where anybody who picks crops gets to stay in the country and bring their whole family. That is something we really can't allow. So we can help out in the sense that we offer jobs, but those jobs are not forever, and they don't mean that you get to come and stay in America. So I'm not sure how to do that. That's a problem we haven't solved yet.
So, Professor, look into your professorial NYU crystal ball there. I mean, is there going to be any politician in the near future or further future out that's going to have the guts to get up in front of the American electorate and said, listen, I know, this is like a baseball umpire. I'm going to tick off 50% of the people 50% of the time, but we've got to start from a clean sheet on this. Is that likely to happen?
It could happen. I think the public is really upset about this. I think many races for Congress next fall are likely to turn on the immigration question. This is something Republicans are running against and running against the Biden administration, and they should. It's a big issue. It's probably the biggest issue in the election. So it's going to get some attention, and Democrats are going to have to change their tune, if they want to stay in office.
And all they have to do, Professor, is look at the poll numbers. Mr. Biden right now, with all the things he's dealing with, I think he ranks out the lowest, if not second lowest, on immigration. It's in the mid-30s.
Yeah.
So that tells anybody, Professor, that can read a poll here, that's not just all Republicans disliking it. There are some Democrats and moderates as well.
That's true, but Biden is most concerned about the left wing of the Democratic Party, which is very much in favor of open borders, which believes that any restrictions are wrong. And those people have a lot of influence, especially in Congress, as it now is. And therefore, they have some influence. And Biden's going to have to reach some understanding with them, because we can't go on like this.
Professor Lawrence Mead, professor of politics at NYU, the author of Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference and the American Power. He hosts the Poverty and Culture podcast, and you can check him out, The Border Crisis and American Culture, at townhall.com. Once again, Professor Mead, thank you for stopping by. We appreciate it. Happy holidays, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Okay, see you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There you go. Professor Lawrence Mead, one of our go-to guys here about politics and power and the border and all that from New York University, NYU. Man, I was just kidding here on our commercial break with Eric. I'm like, oh, man, he's talking sense on the border. It's got to upset some of those more progressives at NYU in the Big Apple. We haven't talked with this gentleman in a while, and he, along with some other folks at the Yankee Institute, have updated a key report that first came out in 2018. The 2021 update is out now for warning signs. And it's a look at the financial stress that all of Connecticut's 169 cities and towns face. Every one of the big cities down through the medium cities and towns to the sleepy little hamlets that we so peacefully drive through on the weekends. Ken Girardin's with us from the Yankee Institute. Hey, Ken, it's Paul here. Good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Good to be back with you.
This must have been a real task. I mean, you're looking at this for 169 cities and towns. Boy, this better have been a labor of love for you, because I can only imagine that your eyes must have been glossing over with all the numbers you saw here.
I am still seeing them when I close my eyes at night.
So how do you put something like this together, Ken, with trying to get data of burdens per person and everything? What's the actual process and the flow to get a report like this put together so people can digest the whole thing?
Every town and city issues an annual financial report where they lay out in 50 to 300 pages how much tax revenue they take in, mm-hmm. what their annual spending is, what their debts are, what their promises to the retirees are. It's all in there. We take it, we pull it together into tables, and then we do a little math on it. So for one thing, we look to see how much debt you have, and then how much money you have to pay for those debts, how much investments you have. We look to see how that compares to how much you take in taxes. And then we pull some other information. We look at how unemployment is in your area. We look at how home values have changed in the past year or two. And we bring it all together and we digest it into a two-digit number, a score that ranged from 12 to 84 for every town and city in the state, so that we could get a sense of how fiscally comfortable your community is. In the case of a score under 50, and about a third of towns and cities got scores below 50, that's associated with fiscal distress. Now, it doesn't mean that all 50 or so of those folks are in trouble. But if you look at the very bottom, where you have scores in the teens, you see that these people have a lot on their plates. And, you know, each community is different. Each community has different circumstances. The lowest scoring community in the state, and this surprised me, was Stratford. Stratford got a 12. Bridgeport is off the hook as worst ranking, thanks to Stratford. Stratford got a 12. They have a lot of debt, particularly pension debt, and promises they made to the retirees about health care that they would pay for. But they didn't set aside enough money to pay for them. So Stratford has considerable legacy employee costs. And the big problem with those is they mean that employers gave, or I should say, Stratford had people do work for them for years and years and years and didn't set aside enough money and didn't collect enough taxes at the time to pay for those services. And they shifted the cost of those services to the next generation. So they're essentially making the people who live there today pay more in taxes than they should be for the services that they're getting now, because they're paying for services that were done 10, 20 years ago.
All right, Ken, hang on. I want to get deeper into this because a lot of people are hearing this likely and saying, yeah, see, what a surprise. Ken Girardin is the guest. Ken, hang on. Be right back with you. Ken is Director of Policy and Research at the Yankee Institute. The new report is out, Warning Signs, a 2021 update. More with Ken straight ahead. More about Stratford. More about Bridgeport coming up first. Traffic and weather together right here, 436 on WICC. And the name of the report is Warning Signs 2021 Update, first done 3 years ago by Ken Girardin, the Director of Policy and Research, and the other folks at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, looking at a overall scores to the fiscal health of cities and towns, all 169 here in the state. We continue with Ken. So, Ken, basically, we're looking at a scenario where years and years and years ago, when some municipalities and some departments or whatever, when they couldn't get people with right up front salaries, the idea was, well, we're going to offer you really good benefits, gold-plated benefits here, retirement, health, and medical. And you're saying the problem is a lot of municipalities, you point to Stratford, but we'll get to other ones around the state, they just didn't pay the price tag over the years and kept, what, kicking the can down the road.
That's right. They didn't set aside the money to pay for the benefits they were promising.
Wow. It's not good. I mean, Ken, I mean, I've been following this, and, you know, people do in these cities and towns raise their voices, and as they do at the state level in the General Assembly, right? Voices are raised. Hey, we have to get serious about this. But in a lot of time, it just doesn't happen sometimes.
That's right. That's right. The real dangerous thing that the report also tries to highlight is that a lot of these places are still digging. They are still making promises for pensions. They are still making promises for retiree health care and not setting aside enough money to cover them.
And in the past 3 years, you note in this hearing, which is fascinating. So when you did this 3 years ago, the unfunded pension and retiree health care costs 3 years ago were a bit over $22 billion. Now you say it's $27.5 billion that you say is unfunded, not paid for. And I guess, Ken, to put that in some perspective for our listeners, the entire state budget for a year is generally $22, $23, $24 billion. So we're looking at that minimum to get out of this hole here.
That's right. And it's going to keep growing as long as people keep adding to the future promises. And frankly, as long as they keep making unrealistic assumptions. So for instance, every community has set aside at least some money to cover their pensions.
Yeah.
It's often not enough, but they take the money that they've set aside and they assume that they're going to get a 7 or 7.5% return on that. Those are Bernie Madoff figures. Those are the kinds of, no broker is going to is going to say that you can realistically expect to get 7 or 7.5% return. And yet our mayors and first selectmen sign off on financials all the time where they make those assumptions. Bridgeport assumes they're going to get a 7% return. Stratford is only slightly better. They're at 6.75%. But these are not realistic assumptions long term.
So why does it keep getting done?
Partially because the General Assembly allows it. And on the one hand, that's generally a good thing. It's generally a good thing when Hartford lets the town councils and the cities do their own thing. In a case like this, where it has the potential to become Hartford's problem, as it did with Hartford itself. Remember, state taxpayers are going to be bailing out Hartford for the next 17, 18 years because Hartford couldn't pay their own bills. And we're going to be bailing them out to the tune of $750 million. That's why this report is so important. That's why state government should probably put some guardrails on the assumptions that these localities can make. They should say, don't go assuming that you're going to get a better return than the state is going to get on their pensions, because the state assumes less than 7%.
This isn't, Ken, all about the big cities and towns here, the big ones. You know, everybody immediately thinks Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, Waterbury, Danbury. But you point out some things here. Now, you do point out that, yes, New Haven has the highest unfunded pension debt per capita at nearly $6,400. But too hardly big cities here are in real distress. Naugatuck residents have the highest unfunded retiree health care liabilities, $15,000 ahead, and the town of Hamden is in really bad fiscal shape here at $20,000 debt per capita. Hamden, the highest in the state. That's a big wow.
Yeah, and one of Hamden's problems is that they have really run out of cushion. At one point, they had effectively no money left in the checkbook. They were really, the town government was really operating hand to mouth. The rule of thumb is you want to have, about 10 or 15% of your annual budget as your balance in your checkbook at any given time. I'm oversimplifying it here, but you want to have some kind of cushion in case something comes up. You have an emergency, global pandemic comes to mind, something like that. You want to have some cushion. And they do not. And if you look at the towns that are in really good shape, they're the ones that have a lot of fund balance. So that if they have a curveball come at them, or if they're, their costs go up for some unanticipated reason, they've got the money set aside to pay for it. Hamden does not. They just have a mountain of debt, and 10 cents of every dollar that they collect in taxes goes towards paying off their pension debt. That's without getting into their other bonded debt. That's without covering their retiree health care costs. 10 cents on the dollar has to go towards their pensions.
And finally, Ken, I mean, obviously some of, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you would think some of these cities and towns are in a position where they're going to have to raise taxes. I guess if for nothing more than, say, Hamden's case, you got to get some cash flow going here or more of it.
Well, I don't want to go telling a local government what they need to do or don't need to do. But one thing I would encourage folks at home to do is take a look at your town or city, take a look at your score, find out what kind of assumptions are baked into that score. Is your mayor, is your first electman being realistic about how they expect investments to perform? Or is this debt going to get worse over time as the investments fail to keep up? That's number one. And then question number two is, are we still digging? Are we still promising pensions? Are we still promising retiree health care? I mean, these are both things that are increasingly rare in the private sector because they're really hard to plan for. They're really hard to set aside enough money for. And they are vanishing in the private sector. The public sector shouldn't be engaging in something that the private sector knows better than to be pursuing. So they should be asking, are we still putting ourselves on the hook for these costs down the line that are going to be a problem for us 10 years from now or a problem for our kids?
Ken Girardin, Chief Policy Analyst for the Yankee Institute of Public Policy online, yankeeinstitute.org. And you can go there. It's on the splash page. And, Ken, I will put a link to it, too, on our Facebook page as well. Ken, good to speak with you again. We'll talk down the road. Happy holidays, and take care. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Paul. Take care.
All right, thanks. Ken Girardin there. And, folks, I will effort to put a link to this report. You can see how Bridgeport is doing, and Stratford, and Trumbull, and Ansonia, and all the area towns, Fairfield County, New Haven County, all over. It'll be on our Facebook page.